Thank you, Don, for that very gracious and fatigued introduction. So, first, I really want to take this opportunity to thank the organizing committee who worked very, very hard. I was on the committee really in name only. I did not pull my weight, for the record. But these folks really managed to put together an amazing 2.5 days of programming. And I have to say that just standing here now speaking to you after hearing this morning's program, this afternoon's program, I feel very honored and a little bit daunted to come up and speak to you, for those of you who are here for those programs. It was some very, very important things were said, and I learned a great deal just from half a day. So I don't remember what my talk was titled, but whatever it is, that's probably not what I'm going to talk about. I'm not really a theologian. I'm just starting to try to make sense of how all this work that we do fits into a religious spiritual framework. I was a student of theology when I was in rabbinical school, and I have the theologians who I admire and who I learn from, but I'm not quite ready to call myself a theologian yet. So toward the end of my talk, I'll throw in a little bit of theology, but really the comments that I have for you tonight are really just thinking out loud about where I am on the issue of Israel-Palestine, and particularly at this moment when I think there's something going on in the movement. I agree with what Sandra said this afternoon, that the word intersectionality is starting to become a bit of a catchphrase. But I do believe that there are important connections that are being made and are invigorating the movement in remarkable ways. And coming from the Jewish community, and particularly working with young Jews who are smart, skilled, amazing, and passionate organizers who I've learned from as well, I think there's something in the air. And so really what I would like to share with you is just a little bit of my own thoughts about where we're at this particular moment. So when I was listening to Dr. Ray speak this morning, talking about the mythos, the Zionist mythos, and that modern states typically have their mythology, that resonated for me. For most of my life, I've considered myself a Zionist. I grew up in an environment where Zionism and Judaism were really synonymous. And I bought into that mythos in a very powerful way. And I would often, looking back, I remember I would often think of or refer to Zionism as the national liberation movement of the Jewish people. And you'll sometimes hear Zionism referred to that way today. By Zionists of all stripes. And, you know, I knew my history. I was actually a history major as an undergraduate. I knew about colonialism. But the Zionist mythos was so strong that it was very difficult for me to understand how a European, how I could possibly describe this European nationalist movement that colonized historic Palestine could somehow be a liberation movement, that liberation movements traditionally or typically, historically, struggle against colonial powers. So I've personally come a long way, but I've on that particular score. But I remember nothing would make me or others who consider themselves passionate Zionists angrier than hearing Israel referred to as colonial, because that really goes to the heart of the myth. And to demonstrate that, I want to read a quote to you from a book by Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. And I'm sure most of you have heard of Heschel. He is a very iconic figure, not only in the Jewish community, a theologian who came here from Europe, taught at the Jewish Theological Seminary, was a very important modern Jewish thinker, and also was very iconic for his bravery in standing in solidarity with civil rights during the civil rights movement, when that was not something that most rabbis were doing at the time, certainly rabbis of his generation. So he is often seen, I think, by most people, even less for his theological work than he is for his civil rights work. But he wrote a book toward the end of his life called Israel, An Echo of Eternity. I'm curious, has anyone here ever heard of this book? Well, you don't count. You know, he wrote very classic books, God in Search of Man, Man is Not Alone. Israel, Echo of Eternity is not one of his classics, and I don't know the history of it, other than I remember hearing, and I'm still trying to do research on this, that it was a book that the Jewish community was waiting for him to write. It was written in 1967. He died a few years after that. And I just want to read to you a quote from this book to give you an idea of what I was talking about in terms of the Zionist mythos. There is no greater fallacy than to regard Israel as a colonial phenomenon. No state in the world expresses the concept of nationhood more intensely than Israel. It is the only state which bears the same name, speaks the same tongue, upholds the same faith, inhabits the same land as it did 3,000 years ago. Recently, a group of young Israelis near the Dead Sea came across some parchment scrolls written 1,900 years ago. They are entirely intelligible to a young citizen of Israel today. Israel is not alien to the Middle East, but an organic part of its texture and memory. The long separation has had less effect on the region's history than the original birth and the modern renewal. Take Israel and all that has emanated from Israel out of Middle Eastern history, and you evacuate that history from its central experiences. Arab political and intellectual leaders have never made a serious effort to understand, even in reluctant mood, the tenacity, depth, and authenticity of Israel as a national reality with deep roots in the Middle East. So I read this to you not to throw Heschel under the bus, but to demonstrate that even one as him, who understood the concept of justice and I think put his own self on the line in important ways, bought into this myth. You know, Don this morning referred half-jokingly to the concept of PEP, Progressive Except for Palestine. I don't think that term existed back then, but it's been around for a long time, this phenomenon. And that speaks to the power of this narrative. I mean, just listening to these words, you can really pick them apart, that he insists on the Jewish indigeneity in the land. And he refers, you know, he refers repeatedly to it as the Middle East, when really ancient Israel was part of the ancient Near East. And conflating those two things, trying to make that unbroken, sort of seamless narrative from ancient times to now, I think is a very seductive narrative. So I do understand it, but I also have come to realize in important ways that Israel is indeed a settler colonial state. I have come to understand, though, that this word is bandied about a great deal. It's also become a bit of a buzzword, and I think it's important to really know what we're talking about when we use that term, particularly in the context of Israel-Palestine, but also in the larger context, in the wider struggle for systems of oppression in U.S. and around the world. So just to define our term, many people use the word settler colonialism and colonialism interchangeably, but in fact they're not the same thing. Colonialism is really defined as largely as a time period. It refers to the policy or practice of power in extending control over weaker people or areas, often referring to a period that lasted from the 16th to mid-20th centuries, in which Western imperial powers did their work of colonizing. Settler colonialism, which is a more recent term, is a different kind of concept, and I want to quote now from Professor of Anthropology Tate Lefevre. She writes, "Though often conflated with colonialism, more generally, settler colonialism is a distinct imperial formation. Both colonialism and settler colonialism are premised on exogenous domination, but only settler colonialism seeks to replace the original population of the colonized territory with a new society of settlers. This new society needs land, and so settler colonialism depends primarily on access to territory. Britain, for example, implemented the doctrine of terra nullius, land belonging to no one, to claim sovereignty over Australia. The entire continent was thereby declared legally uninhabited, despite millennia of Aboriginal occupation." And when I read this definition, you know, that immediately, I'm sure, as you heard these words, you know, the light goes off. Colonialism refers to events. Settler colonialism is an ongoing process. And it's a process by which Israel was founded. And it is a process that is occurring today, even as we speak. It is not in any way anti-Semitic to refer to Israel as a settler colonial state, according to this definition. I think it's a political definition that's responding to a political movement. I was also struck, and you may have been struck, by the British colonial concept of terra nullius and the early Zionist slogan, a land without a people for a people without a land. And this is not to say that Zionists literally thought the land was empty. I think they most certainly recognized that there was an Arab population in Palestine. But it does mean, I think, that they didn't really factor the indigenous inhabitants into their equations. And when they did, it was invariably as a problem to be dealt with. And I think that's very much the case today. You're founding an ethnically Jewish state that's predicated on a demographic majority of people of one ethnicity, people who don't share that are automatically otherized. They're automatically need to be dealt with in some fashion. So many who reject Zionism as settler colonialism argue, as Heschel did, that there are historic biblical connections of the Jewish people to the land, and that the Jews are the true indigenous people who have been longing for a return and restoration to their ancient homeland for centuries. I think Dr. Ray this morning very eloquently demonstrated how the invoking of this mythic biblical past is precisely that. And it is something that, as we learned, modern nation states do, creating these mythos that are so central to who they are and what they do. I think it's also important to keep in mind that the break between biblical times and today is important because that's the period in which Judaism as we know it really developed. Judaism as we know it was not really practiced in the land of Israel and historic Palestine. Judaism as we know it really evolved after the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in 73, and the Jewish people became dispersed throughout the diaspora, and they radically reconstructed Jewish tradition in order to be portable. The priestly aspect of ancient Israelite religion was done away with. The center of worship, the temple in Jerusalem, was gone. They needed a Judaism, a Jewish tradition, that was portable, that God could be found wherever Jews went throughout the world. And Jewish law then became central. The Pharisaic system became central. And traditional Judaism, as we know it, was really, as I like to think of it, sort of a spiritual roadmap for living in the diaspora. That is what Judaism was in its origins, and that's what it is still today. Zionism, it's important to keep in mind, is a very radical idea. It's a modern idea. And we today, I think it's common to conflate Judaism and Zionism, but people need to know, I think we need to remind ourselves that in its origins, it was considered very, very radical. It was a movement of Jewish modernity, among many other movements of Jewish modernity. And the notion of creating a Jewish nation state in historic Palestine was considered very, very radical. And I think Zionists considered themselves radical. They wanted to redefine what it meant to be Jewish. There was a concept, a central Zionist concept called Shlilat HaGalut, the negation of the diaspora. Zionism saw the diaspora as an inhospitable place for Jews, whether through anti-Semitism or through assimilation, and that unless the Jewish people had a homeland of their own, like other peoples at that time who were pursuing their nationalisms, the Jewish people would never be in power. They would always be subject to the powers that be in the nations in which they happen to live. So they were very deeply influenced by European nationalisms of its day and sought to create that kind of a state, to bring that kind of a state into historic Palestine. And thereby doing that, creating, as I said, a new kind of Jew, not the weak, passive shtetl Jew who endured pogroms and espoused a kind of quietist mentality that we were waiting for the Messiah, and if we just, you know, keep calm, and don't make too much noise, we'll be fine. The Zionists used that stereotype to reject in favor of the strong, you know, the strong Israeli, the powerful, militarily powerful, physically powerful ideal. So as I think about that, this radical revisioning of Jewish life and culture in many ways is the exact opposite of indigeneity. I would argue to those who, like Heschel and others, who claim Jewish indigeneity in the land, I would argue that the culture, Israeli culture, that emerged out of European, white European nationalism, was not indigenous at all. It was a product of Europe and brought in. It was also a certain kind of Judaism, Ashkenazic Judaism, and it was transplanted into the Middle East. Now, I want to make it clear, I'm not at all saying that Jews have no connection to the land or that they have no right to live there. The land of Israel has always been central in the in Jewish theology and Jewish liturgy, and the idea of a mythic return when the Messiah comes is a focal point of Jewish prayer. But the land was really spiritualized as a religious focus. It was never suggested until the birth of the Zionist movement that Jews should go and form a state, a third Jewish commonwealth, a state of their own. In fact, the rabbinic authorities throughout the centuries forbid that. They might consider individuals living there, certain authorities would consider moving there to be a mitzvah, a commandment, you know, a sacred thing, but to move en masse to create a Jewish state was forcing the hand of God. You didn't do that until the Messiah came. And again, Zionism sought to overturn this. So this is not about a Jewish right to the land. It's really about understanding how colonialism has had an impact on the true indigenous people of that land. Now, I want to also emphasize at this point that when we're talking about European Jews, I think we need to admit that they never really had the opportunity to be indigenous anywhere. They were expelled from, during the Middle Ages in particular, from many different Christian nations. And the term wandering Jew comes from a very real historical reality. Jews were never able to make roots and set down roots in Europe for centuries. And I think in many ways the political yearning that came out of Western Europe that created the Zionist movement was in large part a result of that sense of rootlessness. However, I think it's also interesting to note that to compare the experience of European Jews to the experience of Jews from the Middle East and Arab countries, and countries that today, such as Iraq and Syria and Egypt, these are Jewish communities that were there for centuries. In some cases, the Jewish communities that trace their lineage even back to before there were Arabs in those countries. There was Jewish indigeneity, I would argue, in many of these countries. And I think much of that had to do with the fact that it was not easy to be Jewish during most of Jewish history, but it was much better to be Jewish under Muslim rule than Christian rule. And that needs to be said out loud as well. It's Jews and Christians in the Muslim Empire were dhimmis, they were second-class citizens, but that was also a category that gave them a protected status. They were considered tolerated or protected minorities. And this gave them stability in Muslim lands and a sense of continuity. I remember I went to Iran several years ago with the Fellowship of Reconciliation and an interfaith delegation. And this was just at the beginning of all of the saber rattling coming from Israel and the United States. George Bush was at the end of his tenure at the time. And part of our trip was visiting with Jewish communities in Iran. And my only experience with Jewish Iranians were the ones who left after the fall of the Shah and moved to Los Angeles. There's a large community of them where I'm from. But the Jews who remained, it was pretty mind-blowing to me, I have to say. I went to Shabbat service in Tehran with other Jewish, and you know, our whole delegation actually went. And it was not even the largest synagogue, but there were probably between 300 and 400 people there. It was on a Friday night. There was no security to be seen. There were kids, you know, sort of running in and out, you know, into, onto the sidewalk, back into the sanctuary. You know, and comparing that to synagogues in Europe, it was kind of just a mind twister. The other thing that I think was really that really struck me about Iranian Jews is how fiercely proud they were of their Persian heritage. And that's something that all Iranians share, whether they're Muslim or Christian or Jewish or Zoroastrian. They all deeply identify as Persians. And the Persian Jews that we met really schooled us on Persian Jewish history. It was clearly very proud to them. They were very proud of it. And I was really struck by that as a second generation, third generation American whose grandparents immigrated here from Europe. I don't have anywhere near, as in my Jewish identity, a sense of culture than the Jews I met in, or Jewish culture, than the Jews I met in Persia. I wanted to commend to you, by the way, on this subject, the work of a scholar named Ella Shohat, who is from Iraqi heritage, but lived in Israel for many years and is now in the United States and really has done a great deal of research on the experience of, the term is used interchangeably, Mizrahi Jews, Sephardic Jews, Arab Jews, Jews from Arab countries, but that's the demographic we're talking about. And I think when we're talking about Israel as a settler colonial state and Israel as a white supremacist state, which we heard this afternoon, I believe, from Sandra reminded us, which is closely linked to settler colonialism, it's important to factor in the experience of Arab Jews in the equation as well. So I just want to read to you a little bit of Shohat's observations. Within Israel, European Jews constitute a first world elite, dominating not only the Palestinians, but also the Oriental Jews. The Sephardim, as a Jewish third world people, form a semi-colonized nation within a nation. My analysis here is indebted to anti-colonialist discourse generally, Franz Fanon and Aimé César, and specifically to Edward Said's indispensable contribution to that discourse, his genealogical critique of Orientalism as the discursive formation by which European culture was able to manage and even produce the Orient as a constellation of traits, assigning generalized values to real or imaginary differences, largely to the advantage of the West and to the disadvantage of the East. And she goes on to write about their experience, their previous experience in Muslim nations. The Sephardi communities, while retaining their strong collective identity, were generally well integrated and indigenous to their countries of origin, forming an inseparable part of their social and cultural life. Thoroughly Arabized in their traditions, the Iraqi Jews, for example, used Arabic even in their hymns and religious ceremonies. The liberal and secular trends of the 20th century Jews to achieve a prominent place in public and cultural life, for example, books from other languages into Arabic. Jews distinguished themselves in Iraqi Arabic speaking theater, in music, as singers, composers, and players of traditional instruments. In Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Tunisia, Jews became members of legislatures, of municipal councils, of the judiciary, and even occupied high economic positions. The finance minister of Iraq in the 40s was Ishaq Sassoon, and in Egypt, Jamas Sanyua. Higher positions, ironically, than those usually achieved by Sephardim within the Jewish state. Sephardim within the Jewish state even though Israel is now a majority, about 60% Sephardi state population now, upon their arrival were treated as second-class citizens. The way a Western culture would Orientalist culture you might imagine would treat them. They, in many instances, many of the early Sephardic immigrants to Israel found common cause with Palestinians, as a matter of fact. And there was in the 60s an Israeli version of the Black Panther Party that stood in solidarity with Palestinians. So these are factors that we need to consider when we think about Israel, that it's a form of Ashkenocentrism. I appreciate that Sandra identified white supremacy in Israel as a an important part of its culture, but also, as she pointed out, that it's not only in Israel. And I think we need to bear that in mind as well, and I want to underline that Israel could never have been created without the help of the great world powers, Great Britain and later the U.S., who supported the creation of the Jewish state because it advanced their own imperial agendas. James Baldwin wrote an essay in 1979, after, you may remember, when Andrew Young was U.N. ambassador and was Jimmy Carter, Carter said never said it was him, but he was relieved of his post because he met with the representatives of the PLO. And Baldwin wrote a pretty scathing, angry essay in The Nation magazine. We also think of Carter today as something of an icon, but he took Carter down a few pegs because the Carter of that time was the one who was supporting the Shah, and this was during the upheaval in Iran. And Baldwin said, and this is a quote from that article, because he wrote a great deal about the Palestinians in this article, "The state of Israel was not created for the salvation of the Jews. It was created for the salvation of the Western interests." So we need to bear this in mind. I think this insight explains why the debate over these terms are more than just academic or semantical. Israel's oppressive policies against the Palestinians do not exist in a vacuum. They are part of a larger hegemonic system of white supremacy and institutionalized racism that exists here in the U.S. and throughout the world. I want to turn now to try to understand this in a religious context, to see if there is a spiritual template by which we could project this understanding. And for me, the narrative, the spiritual narrative I always find myself going back to is the Exodus story. And we all know the Exodus story. It's central to Jewish tradition. Certainly, it was central to movements of liberation. It was central to the civil rights movement. It's an important narrative in different forms of liberation theology. And it is a model. It is a model of liberation that is invoked passionately by people struggling to be free. And the thing about our attachment to the Exodus story, which I've found interesting, is that it's really only the first half of the story that we find ourselves attracted to. In fact, the most holy books in Jewish tradition are the first five, the Torah. It ends before they cross over into the land. I did a Torah study in my former congregation every week, and every week members of the Torah study would say, "What happens after Deuteronomy? We want to know what happens when they settle the land." And I said, "No, you don't want to know what happens when they..." They said, "No." And so finally, we read on. We read Joshua and Judges. We read 1 and 2 Samuel. And I think they finally cried uncle somewhere in the middle of 1 Kings. it was enough. So those of us who cherish the Exodus tradition, I think... viscerally, consciously, or unconsciously avoid the conquest tradition. And I think that's a problem. I think we do it in various ways, whether it's hermeneutical avoidance, whether it's using biblical criticism to say, well, it really didn't happen the way it says it did, or we use many different forms of apologetics to not really deal with the reality of what it is that God is commanding the Israelites to do. God demands Pharaoh let the Israelites go. The God of liberation, however, is also the God of annihilation. The same God commands the Israelites to commit ethnic cleansing of the Canaanites and other nations in that ancient land, according to the story. I think it's important for us to face it because this is not just an academic question. Just as the Exodus story has inspired movements of liberation throughout history, the conquest narrative has been provided religious justification for countless imperialist, settler, colonial movements throughout the centuries. And anyone who cherishes the Exodus tradition needs to reckon with this. It's not only a story about liberation, it's also a story about dispossession and even genocide of indigenous peoples. So, as a Jew, that means I must acknowledge that the conquest tradition was and is used in Israel. It was used by early Zionist ideologues. It was used copiously by political founders of the state. David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister, quoted Joshua over and over. And today it continues to be invoked by the Israeli settler movement and by ultra-nationalist religious authorities in really, I would say, morally repugnant ways, comparing Palestinians to the Amalekites, etc. However, as an American, I also need to admit that this tradition was also explicitly invoked by the early Puritan colonists. I'm glad that several of our speakers noted that we're having this conference on stolen land, and that we need to recognize that this land before we came was the land upon which lived the Potawatomi and the Miami and the Illini and Ojibwe peoples. During the period of manifest destiny, when literal genocide was being committed, the Bible was, conquest tradition was also invoked. So what I'm saying is, when we refuse to face the conquest narrative, I believe we refuse to face our own penchant for conquest. And even more crucially, when we turn away from the conquest narratives, we turn away from the voices of the conquered as well. So I want to, there are many, many theologians from whom I've learned, but to this point, I want to quote one in particular. He's not really a theologian. He's an American Indian Studies scholar and historian and indigenous peoples scholar, Robert Allen Warrior at the University of Illinois. And he comes from the Osage Nation. And he is absolutely unsparing in his challenge to the Exodus tradition and to liberation theologians specifically, and takes them to task for avoiding dealing with the conquest narrative. And as a member of a dispossessed community, Warrior is understandably wary of the promises that the biblical God makes to the Israelites and to the Israelite people. So I want to read to you a little bit from an essay, which I highly recommend, by the way, entitled Canaanites, Cowboys, and Indians. No doubt this story is one that has inspired many people in many contexts to struggle against injustice. Israel in the exile, then diaspora, would remember the story and be reminded of God's faithfulness. Enslaved African Americans, given Bibles to read by their masters and mistresses, would begin at the beginning of the book and find in the pages of the Pentateuch a God who was obviously on their side, even if that God was the God of their oppressors. People in Latin American-based communities read the story and have been inspired to struggle against injustice. The Exodus, with its picture of a God who takes the side of the oppressed and the powerless, has been a beacon of hope for many in despair. Yet the liberationist picture of Yahweh is not complete. A delivered people is not a free people, nor is it a nation. People who have survived the nightmare of subjugation dream of escape. Once its victims have been delivered, they seek a new dream, a new goal, usually a place of safety away from the oppressors, a place that can be defended against future subjugation. Israel's new dream became the land of Canaan, and Yahweh was still with them. Yahweh promised to go before the people and give them Canaan with its flowing milk and honey. The land, Yahweh decided, belonged to these former slaves from Egypt, and Yahweh planned on giving it to them, using the same power used against the enslaving Egyptians to defeat the indigenous inhabitants of Canaan. Yahweh the deliverer became Yahweh the conqueror. The obvious characters in the story for Native Americans to identify with are the Canaanites, the people who already lived in the Promised Land. As a member of the Osage Nation of American Indians who stand in solidarity with other tribal peoples around the world, I read the Exodus stories with Canaanite eyes. And it is the Canaanite side of the story that has been overlooked by those seeking to articulate late theologies of liberation. Especially ignored are the parts of the story that describe Yahweh's command to mercilessly annihilate the indigenous population. And he ends pretty fiercely in rejecting the promise of the God that he refers to as Yahweh, the God the conqueror. He writes, "With what voice will we, the Canaanites of the world, say, 'Let my people go and leave my people alone'? And with what ears will followers of alien gods who have wooed us, Christians, Jews, Marxists, capitalists, listen to us? The indigenous people of this hemisphere have endured a subjugation now 100 years longer than the sojourn of Israel in Egypt. Is there a God, a spirit, who will hear us and stand with us in the Amazon, Osage County, and Wounded Knee? Is there a God, a spirit, able to move among the pain and anger of Nablus, Gaza, and Soweto? But we, the wretched of the earth, may be well advised this time not to listen to the outsiders with their promises of liberation and deliverance. Perhaps we will do better to look elsewhere for our vision of justice, peace, and political sanity, a vision through which we escape not only our oppressors, but our oppression as well. Maybe for once, we will just have to listen to ourselves, leaving the gods of this continent's real strangers to do battle among themselves. So, I think it is possible to find a god of the Amazon, Osage County, and Wounded Knee, and Nablus, and Gaza, and Soweto. I think that is our job. I think that is our sacred task. I also believe that to do so, we need to listen to the voices of the Canaanites of the world, and not only listen to them, but follow their lead. And this, I think, reflects some of the things that Sandra was telling us today, that it's their struggle. And those of us who are part of the system need to own the way we are complicit in that system of oppression, to open our eyes, ears, and hearts to the people who are subjugated by that system, and still affirm somehow, some way, that there is a God that hearkens to the cries of the oppressed, but it is to the oppressed everywhere. I don't think we'll be able to find this God through the conventional Exodus framework, but if our political analysis is based on respecting the agency of those who are most affected by institutional oppression, we must be ready to apply this to our religious analysis as well. We must be willing to ask, when we worship the Exodus God, are we worshiping the God who dispossesses or the gods who stands with the dispossessed? For that matter, are we worshiping a white savior God or the true God of liberation? Do we give praise to the God who liberates only his chosen or the God who chooses all who are oppressed? The festival of Passover begins in a little over a week, and soon enough, Jews the world over will be sitting down at the Seder table to once again retell the story of the Exodus. So in the spirit of the season, I'd like to end my remarks to you tonight with some words that I've written recently for this year's Seder. Your child will ask, why do we observe this festival? And you will answer, it is because of what God did for us when we were set free from the land of Egypt. Your child will ask, were we set free from the land of Egypt that we might hold tightly to the pain of our enslavement with a mighty hand? And you will answer, we were set free from Egypt that we might release our pain by reaching with an outstretched arm to all who struggle for freedom. Your child will ask, were we set free from the land of Egypt because we are God's chosen people? And you will answer, we were set free from the land of Egypt so that we will finally come to learn all who are oppressed are God's chosen. Your child will ask, were we set free from the land of Egypt that we might conquer and settle a land inhabited by others? And you will answer, we were set free from the land of Egypt that we might open wide the doors to proclaim, let all who are dispossessed return home. Let all who wander find welcome at the table. Let all who hunger for liberation come and eat. Thank you.
Speak to your members of Congress. I think we're at an interesting historical moment. If you read the headlines and you see the State Department report, and there's a lot of discussion.
So let me ask a follow-up question to one of the questions. The last one was, were we sent to Egypt to take possession of others' land? And the answer is, okay, Daddy or Mommy, so should all the Palestinians come back to the land? And then what's the answer to that?
The answer that I would give is, it's not up to us to come up with the political solution at the Seder table tonight. It's our job to stand for the simple, basic human rights of people who have been dispossessed from their land and stand with them as they advocate for their internationally recognized right of return. That's our job right now. The political parameters of that, God willing, if we get to that point, will be worked out by the people who have most stake in working that out. But our place is advocating for return.
The Arabs are most of the Semites of this world. That explosion of the myths of origin, that's important because the anti-Semitism directed against Palestinians draws its support from those biblical myths. And I wonder what your thought is about that.
Well, the first thing I would say is I would prefer to avoid the use of the term anti-Semitism because I think it gets us off into unnecessary tangents. I think it was coined to originally mean anti-Jews and anti-Judaism. So I think we need to take the Semitic piece out of the equation and just be clear about what we're talking about, whether we're talking about anti-Palestinian racism, anti-Jewish racism. That would be my preference. Given that, I would say that I agree with Dr. Ray that every Western modern nation state has its mythos. It's not only Israel. This country has its own mythic framework as well. In order to go forward and create the new mythology that he was talking about, I don't think we need to dig in the dirt. I think archaeology and biblical criticism is very interesting. It's an inexact science. It's used politically as well as, you know, Dr. Ray mentioned how it was used in the 18th and 19th centuries as anti-Jewish polemic. It's also used in Israel as a political polemic. Archaeology is a heavily politicized enterprise, and I prefer not to wade into that thicket, frankly. I think it's playing their game. I would prefer to, as Dr. Ray suggested, look forward and say, whatever that old myth was, we reject it. What is our new myth going to look like? I think trying to make claims about what happened thousands of years ago conclusively is just a dead end, and I don't see... I think it's interesting. I enjoy biblical criticism and biblical archaeology review as much as the next person, but I don't look to it to give me answers to the kind of future that we're looking to create for ourselves.
You know, I want to ask you about seeing. He talks about ethnically cleansing, that the Israelis needed to go in your blog, and mm-hmm. you referred it to the New Yorker in the mm-hmm. whole essay, you know. And he says, you know, he just takes the whole article, describes the ethnic cleansing, the whole deal and the massacres. And then he says, do I reject Zionism in Israel? No. Do I turn my back on it? And so, if you just discuss, you know, the mystic sea, you're able to see, and so many people, so many of the other people,
Well, one difference between me and Ari Shavit is I live in the United States and he lives in Israel. You know, everybody, we all come to our own understandings of the world around us in our own way, in our own time, based on our own unique experience. And I have no answer to how to make that work. When I was in my former congregation, I made a point of, when I did my activism, that was my activism, but in the congregation, my job was to create a space for people to work these things out in the way that worked for them. I couldn't force them, and I didn't want to force them to see, as you put it. You know, I could ask the same questions of us as Americans as well. How often do we really reckon with what we have done and are still doing to the indigenous peoples of this country? Are we willing to see in the same way? I think that's an important question for those of us who are part of the system and who benefit from the system in all kinds of tangible and intangible ways. I think we're, in order to get through the day, we're willfully blind to the things that we're complicit in.
You know, I think a lot of us in this conversation, I'm a student here at Garrett, we're constantly sort of asking how do we draw people with us? But as a follow-up, when you creating the space for people to work it out, because I agree, when we drag people kicking and screaming into the light, so to speak, they don't do so well there.
It's not an effective strategy.
What struck me as you're talking about looking at at conquest in the Old Testament is and that's a lot of work, so maybe how you're helping people do that.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up the question of a new hermeneutic. I just love when Robert Warrior says, I read the Bible through Canaanite eyes. And to me, the image that conjures is that our tradition is like a prism. You know, and if we just turn it another way, we read it in a completely new way. It's a completely new story. And that it takes courage to turn the prism. it's very hard to do. And to me, that maybe suggests the beginning of a new hermeneutic, that we willfully allow the light to refract through that prism in different ways, and that's the way we really understand God, the totality of what God is. In terms of creating, and there's much more to say about that, obviously, but in terms of creating safe space, you know, I didn't have none of this on my part was planned. It was not strategic. Even becoming a congregational rabbi wasn't really, I sort of fell into that too. So I guess I'm sort of making it up as I go. But when it came to, I loved working in that congregation. And when I started to go down this path, it was very, very important to me to stay true to who I was, but also to really work hard to let people know that I was their rabbi, and I was their rabbi for whatever they needed me for. And I was committed to that work until it became impossible for me to do. And so I think part of the answer is just knowing where your place is. I have a great deal of respect for, I know rabbis who share similar ideas to me who still work in congregations, and they do it very well. They're very empathic people. They know when to be prophets and know when to be priests. You know, some of it's instinctive. A lot of it has to do with building trust, and that takes time. I think when I started to go down this path, I had been at the congregation for 10 years, and so I think there was a certain amount of trust that had been built up along the way. But when I say you need to know where your proper place is, for me now, I don't think my place is in that community trying to bring people, inside the conventional community trying to bring people along, as you put it. I can't be there anymore. I'm at a different phase personally, and so my approach now is to, I'm outside that border. I'm saying, this is where I am, and if and when you're ready to join me, I'm here. And if you're not, I understand that too. Wherever you end up standing, I think just having integrity and being true to who you are and then letting people see that this is coming from a deep and pure place is the most important thing. I know it can be done because I did in my congregation. I know it's being done in other places as well. I'm going on a trip this summer with a group called the Center for Jewish Nonviolence. We're going to the South Hebron Hills and Hebron itself to stand in solidarity with Palestinian activists there, Youth Against the Settlements and other groups there. And this Center for Jewish Nonviolence is made up of a very diverse group of folks, including liberal Zionists. And it took me a long time to say, do I really want to go on this trip? And I decided to do it because I know personally it can be done. And I think I know in my heart that history is on our side and that a lot of the people who go on these kinds of trips or a lot of people who listen to me they sort of reach out to me and they say, I'm not quite sure, but I want to talk. I think they somehow on some deep level know that and just need people to help them along. And so being open to those people too and not just rejecting people or because you don't agree with their politics, but to be a role model for people, I think, is part of the answer too.
How do we, when we take groups over, when we go with leaders, when you go this summer, how do we speak to our Jewish brothers and sisters in all this diversity and this underlying fear?
I think you're asking the wrong person. You know, this is similar to the answer, I guess, to the question that just came before. I'll be honest with you. When I go now, I've been to Israel many, many, many times, and most of those times were sort of the hermeneutically sealed Jewish Israel. And I have family in Israel, I have friends in Israel, and I would hang out in the Jewish universe. And I'm at a place now where I just can't, I personally can't do that. So when I go there, now I go to the territories. I know eventually I'm going to have to. I have friends who live in Israel. I've lost some friends who live in Israel. But I'm at a place in my life where I'm still working that out. I know many Israelis, many brave Israelis who are part of the BDS From Within movement, who are refusers, share the political analysis and worldview of many of us in this room. I consider them to be brothers and sisters, you know, but I think your point about the emphasis on security is true. And I think in many ways there's sort of a version of the United States, but like to the nth degree. You know, it's sort of a hyper version of the United States, because I think we have to face the fact that we share that fear as well, and our need for security, plus the sense that security can come through greater might, greater physical military might, is toxic. It's, I think, toxic here as well as there. So the only way to engage people, I mean, is to engage them on a human level, one by one, and you know, listen to them, be open to them, and for me, I guess I've spent so much time with them that I feel like I'm trying to make up for lost time for the people who I haven't been listening to, and the voices of the Canaanites, as Warrior would say, and I'm sure I'll find more balance eventually, but. As I said to the earlier question, we all just need to figure out where it is we belong and who are the people we need to be talking with and standing with. And I think we take our cue from that point.